Welcome to Pardes Daily, where you get your daily dose of Torah with Pardes faculty. For the next 2 weeks, Pardes is bringing Purim to you. Let's dive in.
Welcome to Pardes Daily. This is Alex Israel from Alon Shavuot, and we are learning Megillat Esther, Chapter 8. Vayom ahu, Natan ha-melech ha-chashverosh le-Esther ha-malkah et Beit Haman, sorer ha-yehudim, on that very day, Ahasuerus, the king, gave the property of Haman, the enemy of the Jews, to Queen Esther. Mordechai presented himself to the king, for Esther had revealed how he was related to her. And now the king takes Vayasar HaMelech et Tabato, Asher Hivir me Haman. The king took his ring, which he had given to Haman, and gave it to Mordechai, and put Esther and Mordechai over the office of Haman. Haman is dead, everything is fine, and now we totally do not understand the next verses, because we read, and Esther spoke to the king, falling at his feet, weeping, beseeching him to avert the evil plotted by Haman the Agagite against the Jews. If things are so good, why are they so bad? What exactly is going on here? And the answer is clear when you read through chapter 8. Haman has issued letters that on the 13th of Adar, anyone who wants to can kill the Jews. And those letters are still in place. And Esther and Mordechai need to have those letters rescinded. These letters need to be withdrawn so that the Jews will not be destroyed. In other words, the bomb is still ticking. There is still a real problem because the Jews are still sentenced by law to destruction. And the king responds to her in a really curious way. He turns around and says, you know what, I've already killed Haman and I've given you his office. And now you can write whatever you want about the Jews. And you can sign it with the king's signet ring. However, I cannot rescind these letters. Because according to law, once I've made a decree, even I can't retract it. So what exactly are they going to do? Now, here's the fascinating thing. They're going to send counter letters, and the counter letters are essentially going to say that the Jews, on the same day, on the 13th of Adar, have the right to defend themselves. Right? The king has permitted the Jews of every city to assemble and fight for their lives. If any people or province attack them, they may destroy, massacre, and exterminate its armed forces together with the women and children and plunder all their possessions on a single day, on the 13th of Adar. Oh my goodness. That means that the 13th of Adar is a day where there are two contradictory laws. One is that everybody should kill the Jews, and one is that the Jews can assemble and can fight back. And this is really wild. It's actually fascinating that in our tradition, the 13th of Adar, the day before Purim is the 14th of Adar, and the 13th of Adar is kept as a fast day. And it's called the Fast of Esther. Now, here's the strange thing, that Esther, when she fasted, when there was that 3 days in anticipation of approaching the king, Esther actually fasted, but when she was fasting, it was actually on the 13th, 14th, and 15th of Nisan. In fact, it was around Pesach time. It was on Pesach. And probably that year, they didn't even observe the Seder, or if they did, they observed it without matzah and without wine, and it was a very sad Seder. That notwithstanding, when we fast on the 13th of Adar, when we fast on the Fast of Esther, what we're essentially reflecting is the fact that until that day, until the 13th of Adar, nobody quite knew how things would go. Nobody could predict mi yichye u mi yamut, who would live and who would die, because there were these two contradictory laws, these two laws which clashed. And let me say something else about this. You'd think that by this point, Esther and Mordechai are in the driving seat and they can write whatever legislation they want. But if you look at the date in which these letters were dispatched, this new law was dispatched, it says they were dispatched in the third month, the month of Sivan, on the 23rd of the month. Now, just to understand, that's 70 days after Haman's letters went out. That's probably about let's say, 65 days after Haman has been executed. Why did it take over 2 months to get this legislation out? Why did it take 65 days for Esther and Mordechai to write legislation, which again does not contravene, does not cancel the previous edict, but simply allows Jews to defend themselves, that which they weren't allowed to do before? But let's remember that the edict that the Jews be annihilated is still in force. To me, this says something very, very clear. It tells us that there was a huge amount of anti-Semitic feeling in the halls of Shushan, and that there were lots of people who were voting against them, that in the Senate or in the Congress, in the Parliament or what have you, of Shushan, there were many people who were finding all sorts of legal objections and political ways in which to stymie what Mordechai and Esther are trying to do. It's true that they have the favor of the king, but Shushan HaBira is still deeply anti-Semitic, so much so that it takes over 2 months to get a simple edict out which says that the Jews are allowed to defend themselves. In a beautiful use of reversal, the text tells us that this edict goes out in exactly the same way as Haman's letters had gone out. Text of the document was to be issued as law in every province. It would be publicly displayed to all people. The couriers mounted on royal steeds went out in urgent haste, and the decree was proclaimed in Shushan HaBira. And it's only at this point that we all join together in our experience in the Megillah, and we say, and Mordechai went out before the king in royal clothing with a golden throne. And now, in every single kingdom, there's gladness for the Jews. However, as I mentioned, there is still great tension. And here I want to already tread into chapter 9, where, indeed, on that very day, and here I'll read from the first verse of chapter 9, on the 13th of the 12th month, that is the month of Adar, when the king's command and decree were to be executed, the very day on which the enemy's Jews had expected to get them in their power, the opposite happened. And the Jews got their enemies in their power. Throughout the provinces of King Achashverosh, the Jews mustered in their cities to attack those who sought their hurt, and no one could withstand them, for the fear of them had fallen upon all the peoples. In other words, and here we see this also in verse 4, Ki Mordechai Yehudi, Ki Gadol Mordechai Beveit HaMelech, V'Shamo Holech B'Chol HaMedinot, Ki Ish Mordechai Holech V'Gadel. Mordechai was powerful in the royal palace. His fame was spreading through all of the provinces because Mordechai was growing ever more powerful. Indeed, the Jews win the war on that day of the 13th of Adar. But I want to stress maybe two or three details. The first thing is that even though the Jews were allowed to take the spoils, that was exactly the way that Haman's decree was expressed, that ushlalam lavoz, that whoever wanted to could despoil, could take all of the property of the Jews. It's clear that the Jews engage in some sort of ethical war, a war of self-defense, because it says uvabiza lo shalchu et yadam. They did not do a smash and grab operation. They killed those people who were coming to kill them. It was a war of self-defense, but they did not take the booty. They didn't take all of the wealth of their enemies. The second thing that we see, which is strange, is the killing of the 10 sons of Haman. And we even see a very strange item here, where in the first day they kill all their enemies in all the provinces, and they even kill the 10 sons of Haman. But then it says, after this day of fighting, chapter 9, verse 12, the king turned to Esther and said, already in Shushan, the Jews have killed 500 people, including the 10 sons of Haman. What do you want from now? And she says, you know what, give tomorrow that we should fight in Shushan and hang or impale the 10 sons of Haman. What is going on here? And again, I want to come back to what I've said. My sense is that within the corridors of government, there was a huge amount of anti-Semitism. There was no love of the Jews. Otherwise, it really wouldn't have taken 2 months to get those letters out. And the 10 sons of Haman are not 10 little boys. Haman was clearly a person advanced in age. And he's appointed his 10 sons to all sorts of government offices. One might be the Minister of Agriculture. One might be the head of the Senate. One might be the party leader. They're all in very, very powerful positions. And they share Haman's ideology. Why do the Jews, even though they've killed 500 of their enemies in Shushan, need yet another day to kill their enemies? And why do the 10 sons of Haman need to be impaled or need to be hung? Well, that's very clear. The 10 sons of Haman aren't just to be killed, they're to be hung on the tree just like their father. Because as we've already explained, to be hung on a tree is like what happened to Bigdan and Teresh. We are now saying that anybody who is an enemy of the Jews is an enemy of the crown. Anybody who hates the Jews is committing treason. Anti-Semitism is now to be considered to be against the law and an affront against the royal house. And that is why these 10 sons of Haman need to be given the punishment which is given to traitors. Maybe this also explains why they need more time in Shushan, because Shushan, people know how to hide. Some person who's a famous anti-Semite just happens to be away at his country home this weekend. In other words, in anticipation of this day, some of the key players in the game have found ways to make themselves invisible. And it seems like they need a longer period of time to really rout out those people in government who are the opponents of the Jews. So this maybe explains this detail, which almost sounds vengeful. I don't think it's about taking vengeance. I think it's really about solving the problem. I would like to spend our last 2 minutes on another element of the reversal of the story of Purim. And you will have noticed that early on in chapter 8, in verse 3, Haman is referred to, as he is several times in the Megillah, as Haman ha'Agagi, Haman the Agagite. And what is we talking about here? And here I'd like to refer to another reversal. We have a tradition that Haman is descended from Amalek. I'm not quite sure it really makes any sense that he is. Amalek was a Middle Eastern tribe who maybe by this time should be long gone, should have long passed the pages of history. And certainly, why would they find their way to Persia? That having been said, the use of the description Haman ha'Agagi, Agag. Agag was the king of Amalek. And of course, Agag's opponent was Shaul, King Saul. And this is the Haftorah for Shabbat Zachor. Saul failed to get rid of Amalek. In fact, he was deposed as king from God because he didn't get rid of Amalek. But here, this is going to take us straight back into the Megillah, because there are many intertextual references where we see Esther and Mordechai almost acting as a foil, acting as a sort of reflection of King Saul. Let me explain. For example, when Saul is deposed from the kingship, God says, Kara Hashem et mamlechu Yisrael me'alecha hayom, unetana l'reacha hatov mimecha. God has torn the kingdom from you and given it to your friend who's worthier than him. But when Vashti is dismissed, they say the same thing. Let your majesty give her royal state to her l'reuta hatova mimena. Same phrase, l'reacha hatov mimcha, l'reuta hatova mimena. In other words, Esther is indeed sort of taking on the role of Vashti, but taking on the role of Saul. Or like Saul says, Ve'et dvar hamlucha lo higidlo, vahika macharish. He didn't tell the matter of the kingship to his uncle. Likewise, Ein Esther mageret moladeta ve'tama. She doesn't tell about her people. And im hacharish tacharishi, if you're silent at this time, her silence reflects Saul's silence. If Saul, instead of killing Agag, takes mercy over the spoils and takes from the booty. Now we say, Uvabiza lo shalchu et yadam. The Jews did not take the booty. What are we saying here? Somehow we're seeing in this situation a historic wrong put right. We're seeing a situation in which the person who failed to kill the great agitator of the Jews, Agag, all those centuries ago, King Saul, who was removed from the kingship. Now we have Jews who have taken on the kingship, even in a foreign country. but have now themselves got rid of the Agagite, the great anti-Semite, the great hater of the Jews. And this is a way that, in addition to the details of this very localized story, we even see much larger processes, the wrongs of the whole Tanakh being put right. Esther is not just a foreign queen, but she is almost the reincarnation of her ancestor. Mordechai is described as Mordechai ben Yair ben Shimi ben Kish. And of course, Shaul is Shaul ben Kish. So the mistakes of the past Jewish kings are, if you want, corrected by Esther and Mordechai. We're getting to the end, chapter 9 next time. See you then.
Thank you to our Pardes faculty. And a big thanks to you, our learners. Make sure to check back in every day to stay on track with your learning. And visit www.pardes.org.il for more information about other ways to learn with Pardes.